From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Good morning. This hour, how Latin America is responding to U.S. aggression in Venezuela. Also, voting officials brace for possible federal interference in the midterms.
We in the election space have to just use our imaginations, as we would, to be clear, for any threat.
Plus, when calling 911 creates ambulance debt.
That really makes you pause and go, do I really need this ambulance? Can we just risk taking a car instead?
And ahead of the Olympics, we'll talk great winter sports movies, plus a job listing for a treasure hunter. It's Sunday, January 11th. News is next.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with a special edition of the Up North Report. Your property has been assessed, and local governments have set their levies. Your property tax statement will be in the mail by the end of March, and you'll have made your first payment by mid-May. This is the third and final part of our property tax series. If you missed the first two parts, you can find them at kaxe.org. In our last installment, we finished breaking down your tax statement. Now we're going to tie up a few loose ends and dig into how you can be more involved in the process this year. The only thing that isn't set for 2026 is your refund. There are two main property tax refunds for homeowners. You qualify for one of them if your household income is below a certain threshold. You qualify for the other if your property taxes went up by more than 12%. But did you know that the process of calculating your 2027 taxes has already started? County assessors are currently evaluating properties. They'll send your valuation notice to you in March or April. Remember how it says on your proposed tax statement that it's too late to appeal your value? That's because you have to do that in the spring, after valuation notices are sent. The valuation and appeals processes are a whole other rabbit hole. The truth is, assessing properties and calculating taxes are two separate systems, despite how closely connected they are. In Itasca County, the assessor Billy Hillback and auditor-treasurer Austin Rowling's offices are right across the hall from each other. They and their staff are crossing over to talk every day. Rowling and Hillback say they're a team, but by law, they have to work separately.
I control two pieces of the tax system, the calculation and the collection, and he controls the valuation.
And classification.
I could not step in for Bill and start doing his pieces, and he could not step in for me and start doing my pieces.
Spring is also when local governments really start digging into their budgets. By September, they have to set the preliminary levies used for your proposed tax statements. Then those are sent to you in November, and we end up back at truth and taxation meetings in December with people fired up about their taxes. But those meetings are only about one government's budget.
And I think it's due to a lack of understanding.
Yes.
It's not because they've stick their heads in the sand or they don't care until then. It's they don't know enough about how the process works.
A common refrain at truth and taxation meetings is you've sent me my notice in November and I can't do anything about it because you set my value in March. The long, overlapping timelines are part of the reason property taxes are so hard to follow. But values have to be set before taxes can be calculated. In late 2025, the last touches are being put on your 2026 taxes. At the same time, work is already underway to set the 2026 property values in advance of 2027 taxes.
We need you to be more proactive, and it's to your benefit to be more proactive. We want you to be involved. We know the process is complicated, but the process is what we operate within.
Rowling says he would love for all of the budget planning meetings to be as full as truth and taxation. Hillback says talking with taxpayers is a big part of his job.
Because education absolutely dispels misinformation.
I want to peel back the curtains a bit. I knew next to nothing about property taxes when we started this series. To learn more, I talked with Rowling, Hillback, and Grand Rapids City Administrator Tom Pagel. That doesn't even include diving into school levies, which are calculated in an entirely different way. You can also talk to them or their counterparts in your area. I also did a lot of research. Look for write-ups from the Minnesota House Research Department. The nonpartisan explainers written for legislators dive into complicated topics like this in as few as two pages. You can get as deep as you'd like. Time is a very real barrier for a lot of people. But at the end of the day, learning is still an individual responsibility. If you want to know more, you have to get involved and ask questions. There are people who want to answer them. And that includes us. Tell us what you want to know by emailing news@kaxe.org. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. Aisha Roscoe is away. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. A few days after the United States seized the leader of Venezuela and said it would run the country, President Trump was asked if there were any checks on his power on the world stage. Here's his answer.
My own morality, my own mind, it's the only thing that can stop.
And, not international
and that's
law.
Very good.
That's from Trump's two-hour interview Wednesday with the New York Times. The U.S. military action against a sovereign nation without authorization or consultation with Congress is a dramatic shift from previous presidential administrations. It also raises questions about what Trump plans to do next. NPR senior national political correspondent Mara Liasson is with us now to talk about that. Good morning, Mara.
Good morning, Sasha.
In recent years and even decades, we've gotten used to the U.S. working with allies, and that clearly did not happen here. What have we learned about how President Trump thinks the U.S. should use military force?
This was a week when Trump's worldview came into sharper focus than ever before. You just heard him say that nothing can stop him but his own morality or mind. He also said in that interview that he'll be running Venezuela indefinitely. He said, quote, I don't need international law. He also said he's not looking to hurt people. And that stance was previewed earlier in the week by his senior aide, Stephen Miller, who was talking to Jake Tapper on CNN. Here's what he said.
We live in a world, in the real world, Jake, that is governed by strength, that is governed by force, that is governed by power. These are the iron laws of the world
that
have existed since the beginning of time.
But brute power has not been the only ruling force since World War II. It's also been alliances and treaties and international rules backed up by the most powerful military in the world. And the U.S. has abided by them. In Europe, NATO has kept the peace for 80 years. That's a historical record. But the Trump administration seems to be marking a shift to a new kind of global balance of power where three aggressive superpowers, China, Russia, and the U.S., control their smaller, weaker neighbors. Donald Trump has talked about taking Greenland, possibly by military force. Greenland is a territory of Denmark, which is a NATO ally. And in that New York Times interview, Donald Trump seemed to acknowledge this. He said, quote, it may be a choice, unquote, between preserving NATO or getting Greenland.
Mara, on Venezuela, there was some pushback from U.S. lawmakers. Five Republican senators voted with Democrats to advance legislation that would require Trump to get congressional approval before taking more action in the country. How significant is that pushback?
I think it's significant, but that measure is not likely to become law. It is a rare pushback from members of the president's own party, and it prompted Trump to call for all five Republicans who voted with the Democrats to lose their seats. Of those five, only Susan Collins of Maine is up for re-election this year. So Trump does not seem to be in any danger of losing his base or Republican support in Congress over Venezuela. Most polls show Republican voters approve of the operation to get Maduro. It's not clear how they'll feel over time. It depends on if running Venezuela turns into a success or a quagmire. But right now, Donald Trump is extremely confident in his grip on his party. When NBC asked him if his MAGA base, many of whom liked his promise to keep the U.S. out of foreign entanglements, would stick with him, he answered, quote, MAGA loves everything I do. MAGA is me. MAGA loves everything I do.
Trump has been talking a lot about Venezuela's oil, essentially coveting that oil. And he met Friday with U.S. oil and gas executives. How did that meeting go?
Well, it's really interesting because the president has been very enthusiastic about getting Venezuelan oil. That's one of the reasons he said that they did the incursion into Venezuela. But the executives he met with were not as enthusiastic as he was about going back into Venezuela. Trump says he wants to give some of the oil profits to Venezuela. Some of the profits would compensate American companies who had their assets nationalized 2 decades ago. And he says the companies are ready to invest $100 billion. But that's not what we're hearing from the executives. The head of Exxon in that meeting told the president that at least at this time, Venezuela is, quote, uninvestable. And major changes would have to happen before Exxon goes back in.
Amara, in a very different topic, a domestic one, we've been watching, of course, the fallout from the fatal shooting of a U.S. citizen, Renee Good, by an ICE agent in Minneapolis last week. There were protests all over the country yesterday. How much does this incident mark any shift in public sentiment or administration policy?
I think it's too early to tell. There have been a lot of concerns expressed, including among people who support ICE's mission, about how these officers operate. And when they are sent, 10,000 new agents were authorized by Congress in that big funding bill. So these are armed agents going into communities that don't want them there. And there are serious questions about the kind of training that these agents are getting as they are flooding into communities around the country. They say they are there to apprehend undocumented immigrants. But now we've seen several incidences of violence and casualties.
That is NPR's senior national political correspondent, Mara Liasson. Mara, thank you.
Thank you.
Latin America has been swept up in a rapid chain of events over the past week. That's following the U.S. incursion into Venezuela and the removal of its president, Nicolas Maduro. President Trump is projecting U.S. power across the region on a scale not seen since the United States invaded Panama nearly 4 decades ago. But the response from some of Latin America's most strident leftist leaders has been subdued. NPR's Carrie Kahn reports.
Supporters of Colombian President Gustavo Petro streamed into downtown Bogota last week, heeding Petro's calls to defend the nation's sovereignty. After U.S. forces seized Venezuela's Maduro, President Trump hinted that Colombia and Petro, who Trump had accused of being a drug trafficker, could be the next target for U.S. military action. Petro, friend, the people are with you, shouted the crowd as it waited to hear from the 65-year-old leftist leader. After 3 hours, Petro finally appeared in Bogota's huge Bolivar Plaza with a stunning explanation for his delay.
Dice Trump.
He was on the phone with Trump.
Fue un gran honor hablar con el presidente de Colombia, Gustavo Petro.
It was an honor to speak with Colombian President Gustavo Petro, he reads Trump's Truth Social post as the crowd breaks into applause.
Y espero reunirme con él próximamente.
And more enthusiasm as Petro says Trump has invited him to the White House.
In Washington, D.C.
The following day, he posts a picture of a U.S. bald eagle nuzzling a Colombian jaguar. Apart from Cuba's steadfast defiance, Petro has recently become the Latin American left's leading voice, trading insults with Trump. But Massimo Modonisi, a political scientist at Mexico's National Autonomous University, says above all, he's a pragmatic politician. If he's attacked and there is no space for negotiation, Modonisi says Petro resorts to radical rhetoric. Petro is part of a group of leftist leaders in Latin America, including the presidents of Brazil, Mexico, and Chile, that swept into office during the last decade on a wave of progressive promises. But since the U.S. attack on Venezuela, many are taking a strikingly less defiant tone. Here's the newly installed interim president, Delcy Rodriguez, on state TV last week, displaying deft rhetorical skills to exhibit defiance and compliance.
Y no nos vamos a rendir frente a ningún tipo de agresión.
We will not surrender in the face of aggression, she says, while adding, our hands are open to all countries in cooperation, including for energy agreements. a clear capitulation to Trump's demands for a U.S. takeover of Venezuela's oil industry. Even Interior Minister Diosdado Cabello, Venezuela's vociferous ideologue and feared head of the state's repressive police forces, has been mollified in recent days.
Buenas noches a toda Venezuela. Los saludamos desde aquí.
On his long-running state TV show, usually taped before an energetic pro-regime audience, a fidgeting Cabello nervously wrestles papers in his first episode since Maduro's capture.
La misma situación. No.
None of this toned-down rhetoric is surprising given Maduro's capture, says Cornell University political scientist Santiago Anria. That's because Cabello is also a defendant in the U.S. indictment charging Maduro and his wife with drug trafficking. And political scientist Anria says the left in Latin America is at a crossroads.
A left that was already pretty weakened and fragmented by its own mistakes in the past.
The right has made major electoral gains in recent years throughout Latin America, including in Argentina, Ecuador, and most recently Chile. And more wins could be coming this year in elections in Colombia and Brazil. Mexican political scientist Massimo Moldonisi agrees.
La oleada de derecha es muy fuerte y la propia izquierda le ha abierto la puerta abandonando ciertos.
The right political wave now sweeping Latin America is very strong, he says, but don't discount a resurgence of the left. It's long championed unresolved issues the right hasn't, like the gaping income inequality plaguing the region. Cornell political scientist Santiago Anria also urges caution for those declaring the death of Latin America's left.
I think they will be disappointed by that in the longer run, but it is surely a moment of reckoning and of reimagination.
Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Bogota, Colombia.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition, could movement be just as good as medicine? A new study finds that exercise rivals antidepressants and therapy when it comes to treating depression. Even a small dose of movement can alter our brain chemistry.
Exercise can help improve neurotransmitter function, like serotonin as well as dopamine and endorphins. So there is certainly overlap between exercise and how antidepressants offer relief.
Hear that story tomorrow by telling your smart speaker to play NPR. You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Louise Schiavone with these headlines. Across the nation, thousands of people took to the streets Saturday to protest ICE actions that left a woman in Minnesota dead. Hundreds more demonstrations are expected today. Reports from Iran suggest hundreds of people have been killed or wounded by the security forces over the past 3 days as mass anti-government protests continue across the country. Details are emerging despite an internet blackout there. A lone gunman killed six people in Clay County, Mississippi yesterday. Authorities say the victims include the alleged shooter's father, uncle, brother, and a seven-year-old. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. From EBSCO, supporting open source technology and making open platforms possible for libraries of all sizes. Learn more at EBSCO.com. And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Will this year's midterm elections be fair? It's a simple question, but for many state and local voting officials, it has an increasingly complicated answer. That's because of the possibility of interference by the federal government and President Trump. NPR voting correspondent Miles Parks is tracking this issue, and he joins me now. Hi, Miles.
Hey, Sasha.
Miles, your reporting shows that voting officials are already preparing for the possibility of federal interference. Tell us about that prep process.
Yeah. So, I mean, early last year, it became clear to local officials, and I should say from both parties, that the federal government, helmed by President Trump, wanted a bigger role in local processes. Just 2 months into his second term, he signed an executive order aimed at adding new voting restrictions, for instance. Most of that has been blocked by the courts at this point. But he also, his administration laid off much of the election security staff at the Department of Homeland Security. And I was talking about all of that with the Secretary of State of Minnesota, Steve Simon, who's a Democrat. And he said the idea of federal interference is on election officials' minds as they game plan out every scenario.
We in the election space have to just use our imaginations, as we would, to be clear, for any threat, whether it's from a foreign actor, whether it's a natural disaster that we can't quite predict. This falls into that category, too.
Miles, it's noteworthy that you have a state voting official there referring to federal government action as a threat, in his words. Did the Minnesota Secretary of State say what specifically he's worried about?
Well, something Simon talked about, and this is also something I've heard from a number of other Democrats that they're concerned about as well, is the possibility of federal troops being deployed to polling places this year. I asked the White House about this. A spokesperson, Abigail Jackson, referred to these sort of scenarios as baseless conspiracy theories in a statement to NPR, but she didn't categorically rule it out. And the National Guard deployments last year obviously crystallized this as a thing that local officials feel like they need to prepare for, even if this sort of scenario would clearly break federal voting laws. The other possibility that voting officials are talking about is immigration enforcement. It is already illegal for non-citizens to vote in federal elections, but people in Trump's orbit have toyed with the idea of having ICE agents at polling places or involved in the election in some other capacity to guard against non-citizen voting. And any of these scenarios obviously could potentially have a suppressive effect if they make anyone scared to vote.
President Trump has talked a lot about wanting to ban mail-in ballots, voting by mail. What power, if any, does he have over the rules of how people will vote this year?
Essentially none. The Constitution is very clear on this. States set the rules for how their voters vote, and Trump's allies have acknowledged this. But in the fall, Cleta Mitchell, who's a notable far-right election attorney, indicated that Trump could consider a sort of workaround by declaring a national emergency based on election integrity. Here's Mitchell talking on the podcast Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
The president's authority is limited, except that where there is a threat to the national sovereignty of the United States, then I think maybe the president is thinking that he will exercise some emergency powers to protect the federal elections going forward.
Legal experts I've talked to say there's no way this could actually work in practice, but I have heard from voting officials, including local Republicans, who say they're shoring up their relationships with their local and state attorneys' offices in preparation for the potential of legal fights. They're preparing for the possibility of attempts to access their election equipment. And I'll also note that more than a dozen states are already engaged in lawsuits with the Justice Department over requests the Trump administration has made for their voter data.
Miles, a bigger picture question. Trump is not on the ballot, of course. Lay out why he's so interested in how local officials conduct elections.
I mean, at the most basic level, if Republicans lose control of the House of Representatives in midterms, it just becomes very, very difficult for the Trump administration to get anything done legislatively. But this week, Trump also made it clear that his investment in the midterms is personal. He said he thinks that if Democrats win, he will be impeached for a third time. And he's also made it clear that he is willing to mess with the democratic process to advantage himself, right? I mean, we just had the anniversary, the five-year anniversary of January 6th and his attempts to overturn the 2020 election. And even this cycle, we saw Trump spur on this unprecedented mid-decade redistricting. And so for many local election officials, this is not abstract or hypothetical, this idea that Trump would mess with the system to advantage himself.
That is NPR's Miles Parks. Thanks for covering this, and we'll keep talking throughout the year.
Thanks, Sasha.
When you call 911 in a medical emergency, you're not necessarily choosing which ambulance responds. The ambulance company may be outside your insurance network, and you may end up with a big bill. Member Station GBH's Liz Nieslaus has this report and a heads up, especially if you're in a car. Her story includes the sound of sirens.
911, this line is recorded.
One October night in 2023, Keith Ventimiglia, a high school math teacher, was home with his family in Brimfield, Massachusetts, when he was suddenly in extreme pain and couldn't move.
My husband is on the floor.
His wife called 911 and an ambulance took him to the nearest hospital about 16 miles away.
I'm saying the paramedics to help you now. Stay in line. I'll tell you exactly what to do next.
When Ventimiglia's wife made that call, a dispatcher sent the nearest ambulance operated by a private company. It was out of network with his insurance. Not much about an ambulance ride would surprise Ventimiglia. He's a part-time paramedic. But what shocked him was the ambulance bill. It was $6,800.
The single largest by a significant amount of all the other medical expenses.
Still, he wasn't worried. He'd fully recovered and he had insurance. So he sent his bill off. But that one bill would lead to a nearly two-year battle. Ground ambulances were left out of a 2022 law that protects people from surprise emergency medical bills. The result? Those bills can go to debt collection. People get forced into payment plans. Some end up in court.
They can't afford to pay these bills. It's just not a possibility for them.
Lawyer Max Calise works pro bono helping those who've been sued over ambulance debt. He says the bills can be a crushing psychological weight for anyone who's just come out of a medical or mental health trauma. In nearly 30 states, ambulance billing is a largely unregulated system that leaves people on the hook for their emergency transport. Roughly half of all ambulance rides are out of network because many insurers and ambulance providers don't agree on rates. That could be the case whether your ambulance is from a private company or your municipality. As a paramedic, Keith Ventimiglia understands why ambulances don't come cheap.
You got to make sure that truck runs and you have qualified, well-paid people on that truck with good equipment.
Still, he thinks people shouldn't be trapped between their insurance company and the ambulance provider trying to resolve their bill. Insurers and ambulance companies blame each other for the chaos.
We need to rein in ambulance companies.
Laura Pellegrini, president of the Massachusetts Association of Health Plans, says some ambulance companies charge exorbitant rates.
We have been seeing for several years a failure of many of the ambulance companies to contract with the health plans. I think it's bad actors who can get away with it, so they're trying to.
Dennis Cataldo, owner of a Massachusetts ambulance company and a director of the American Ambulance Association, says they're not the villain.
More ambulance companies are choosing not to contract with commercial insurance because the rates just don't support the services that are being provided.
Patricia Kelmar, a senior director at U.S. Public Interest Research Group, has watched the finger pointing for years. She thinks regulators need to step in to protect consumers.
We've been waiting for the market, the insurance market, the healthcare provider market to solve this, and it hasn't happened. And that's the appropriate time to look for regulation.
In the absence of action from Congress, states are stepping in. So far, 22 states have laws that limit patients' responsibility for their bills to what they'd pay in-network.
Action Ambulance versus Keith Ventimiglia.
Action Ambulance took paramedic Keith Ventimiglia to court over his bill. He countersued, and the case was ultimately dismissed. Now free of his billing nightmare, he echoes the refrain of those swept into ambulance debt.
That really makes you pause and go, do I really need this ambulance? Can we just risk taking a car instead?
And with looming federal cuts and changes to Medicaid, millions more will be asking those questions. For NPR News, I'm Liz Nieslaus in Boston.
Faith leaders and their congregations have been at the forefront of protests over recent immigration enforcement actions in Minneapolis, and they say their resolve has been strengthened by last Wednesday's killing of a woman by an ICE agent. NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose has this report.
A vigil for Renee Good at the state capitol this week brought together people of faith from many traditions.
We are justice-seeking people.
Several hundred, many wearing clerical collars or crosses or headscarves or prayer shawls, gathered in the freezing cold as the sun set Friday. Rabbi Jason Rodich of Temple Israel in Minneapolis welcomed the crowd.
We stand here as Minnesotans who do not forget the past, as we join together in acts of solidarity and love.
A love that's active in its care for neighbors.
Peace be with you.
And also with you.
Among the speakers was Lutheran Bishop Regina Hassanali.
I am here to tell you that there is a God who sees our outrage, our lament, our tiredness, and our anger. There is a God who sees.
Across Minnesota right now, mosques are seeing a 20% drop in attendance. It's very scary. People are scared.
Imam Asad Zaman is executive director of the Muslim American Society of Minnesota. He says immigration enforcement actions have been particularly hard on his community, many of whom are Somali, a group targeted in recent weeks by the Trump administration.
There is a verse in the Quran where Allah says, وَلَقَدْ كَرَّمْنَا بَنِي Adam. We did indeed endow all the children of Adam with dignity. What's happening is designed to strip people of their dignity, and that's not right.
You can scan that or you can take a paper one. It saves us some money, but okay, thanks.
Saturday morning, more than 1,000 people gathered at suburban Roseville Lutheran Church to take part in a legal observer training planned long before the killing of Renee Good this past week. Luis Aguerto with the social justice group Unidos helped organize the event.
We just need to make sure that we have as many people aware of their constitutional rights. We want to make sure that we have as many people that can document and be prepared for what's to come.
What's to come, he says, is expected to be difficult, which is why Pastor Marty Wyatt opened his church's doors to the event.
We are all the body of Christ together, and when one part of the body is hurting, we're all hurting. The whole body is hurting. And so we have to come together as the body of Christ, as neighbors, and show up for each other.
Wyatt says he's emboldened by an idea in the book of Genesis, creation of humanity itself.
All of the different ways that we are, all of that diversity is in the image of God. And if we don't recognize that and celebrate that, we are doing a disservice to the image of God and to God.
Among those attending the training was Natasha.
Jesus said, treat your neighbors as you would like to be treated, and I would like to be treated with respect and dignity and have the human dignity of a person and be valued for that.
Natasha asked that we only use her first name because, as a naturalized citizen, she fears legal retribution for speaking out.
It is pushing me out of my comfort zone, but I know I want to be on the right side of history. So it makes me want to keep showing up and doing what I can.
Another attendee is Rachel Wright, who says it is precisely her Christian faith that compels her to protest. And she's proud of why the Twin Cities have so many diverse communities, Somali, Hmong, Latin American.
A large part of the reason why we have a large immigrant community is because of churches. We've welcomed refugees, we've welcomed immigrants, and here we are, a rich community because of that.
Neighbors, Wright says, who follow the biblical mandate to welcome the stranger. Jason DeRose, NPR News, Minneapolis.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Now, a topic that is often very distressing to people living with it. By the age of 65, more than half of men and more than a third of women experience some kind of hair loss. That's according to the National Council on Aging. So the president of South Korea wants his country's national health insurance program to cover hair loss treatment for its citizens. President Lee Jae-myung isn't experiencing hair loss himself, but he says this isn't just a cosmetic issue. He calls it, quote, a matter of survival. S. Hejin Lee has written extensively on Korean beauty standards. She's a Korean-American professor of women, gender, and sexuality at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What was your reaction to President Lee's proposal?
You know, his proposal is so interesting. I think the important part to look at is that he characterizes hair loss as, quote unquote, a matter of survival. And this really references this idea that Korea is a very lookist society. That's not a term that we use too much here in the U.S., but in Korea is very commonplace.
Meaning how you look really matters?
That's right. Not only really matters, but that one can be discriminated against for not looking a certain way.
And by the way, more so in just that often attractive people get treated more nicely. It goes beyond that?
Yes, absolutely. Because in Korea, there's been a long history of photographs being attached to resumes. So literally, right, your looks are your credentials. And that's important because women have been rallying around this for a long time. It's been decades that feminists have been pointing out that lookism is actually a very gendered problem, that women in particular carry the burden of making themselves up to a certain standard. So he's kind of invoking this idea that, you know, your looks is a matter of survival, but he's tying it to a very male problem.
Hair loss more typically comes with aging, but sometimes does also affect young people. I certainly know many men in their 30s or 40s who are starting to feel concerned about that they can see hair loss.
Yeah.
So this might be an opportunity for them to actually think about health insurance and insurance coverage, which when you're younger, you don't have to think about often as much as older people. Any chance that this issue is more likely to get young people engaged in policy, political policy like insurance policy?
It's hard to say. We often think of insurance as something that affects older folks, right? Something you use. And I think he's really connecting insurance to economic survival. But I don't think he's, you know, hoping to necessarily engage the younger generations in insurance policy so much as make them feel heard and seen and maybe win their votes in the process. But what is interesting is that there's many ways to address these quote-unquote matters of survival. The government plays a role in shaping these beauty expectations. You know, it also plays a role in providing the solutions to these expectations, right? So what I mean here is that the government benefits from its popular culture industry, which is a purveyor of these beauty standards. It provides the solutions, right? We all know K-beauty is, you know, a multi-billion dollar industry. And now, it's interesting that he's not proposing to change any of those areas, but what he is proposing to do is to cover a very small fragment of a solution.
That's S. Hejin Lee. She's a professor at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
You are tuned in to Weekend Edition here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Lakeland PBS, offering 24/7 PBS Kids programming, the PBS Kids video app, educational resources for teachers, parents, and more at lptv.org. Find the latest Up North report at KAXE.org. News from our region, heard on The Morning Show, World Cafe, and All Things Considered, or as a podcast. Is there news in your region we should know about? Email news at kaxe.org. The Beltrami County History Center hosts a program with community members who have traced their families back to the American Revolution, Wednesday, January 14th at noon. Learn how they used genealogy and other documents to uncover stories of their ancestors. And the City of Grand Rapids hosts an open house Wednesday, January 14th from 4 to 6 at Yonmar Arena. Share your feedback on plans for American Legion Memorial Park.
I'm Louise Schiavone with these headlines. President Trump is proposing a one-year 10% cap on credit card interest rates, and he wants to see it in place by January 20th. The change could save Americans tens of billions of dollars. The music world is remembering Grateful Dead co-founder Bob Weir, who has died at the age of 78. Weir was the rhythm guitarist for the jam band. He also sang lead vocals on some of their songs. His family said the cause was underlying lung issues. American skier Lindsey Vonn won her second World Cup downhill event of the year this weekend, finishing with a 0.37-second lead in a Saturday race in Austria. The 41-year-old Vonn now has 2 wins in 3 events. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at au.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, and it's time to play the puzzle. Joining us, as always, is Will Shortz. He's puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition. Hi, Will.
Hey there, Sasha.
Will, remind us of last week's challenge.
Yes, it came from Ed Pegg Jr., and it was a math puzzle. I said, take the 9 digits, 1 to 9, in order, and I said you can group them and add arithmetic operations to get 2011 in a certain way. Then I asked, can you group them and add arithmetic symbols in a different way to make 2026? And there's several answers. One of them is 12 times 34 times 5 minus 6 minus 7 plus 8 minus 9. And there are a couple of others, which I think we will list on the NPR website.
A great challenge for math lovers. And there were 452 correct entries. And this week's winner is Daniel Abramson of Albuquerque, New Mexico. Congratulations, Daniel.
Hi. Thank you.
Explain how you figured out that one.
I was just playing around with multiplication to see what would get me close. I started with the higher numbers, got nowhere with that, and then hit on the, 12 times 34 times 5, and I was so close. It was like, well, let's just add and subtract to see what gets us to 2026.
Are you a regular player of the puzzle?
Yeah, I've been doing it for, I feel like, 6-7 years.
And what other kinds of things do you do when you're not playing the puzzle?
Well, I'm a software engineer, and in my free time, I'm a percussionist with the Albuquerque Concert Band.
Oh, wow. So many interests. Right brain and left brain. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Are you ready to play the puzzle today?
I'm a little nervous, but let's go for it.
I'm here with you. We'll do it together. Will?
Yeah, don't be nervous. All right, Daniel and Sasha. Today's puzzle is called Pet Theory. Every answer is a familiar two-word phrase or name in which the first word starts P-E, and the second word starts T. For example, if I said what walkways at intersections carry, you would say pedestrian traffic. Here's number one, a chart that lists all the chemical elements.
The periodic table.
That's it. A place for a partridge in the 12 days of Christmas.
A pear tree.
That's it. A male voyeur.
Oh gosh, a peeping Tom.
That's it. What a coach gives a team during halftime in the locker room.
A pep talk.
Uh-huh. A set of questions designed to reveal your traits.
A personality test.
You got it. Something combatants sign to end a war.
Peace treaty.
That's it. Someone who works with you one-on-one with physical exercises.
Personal trainer.
You got it. Member of the Who.
Oh, Pete Townsend.
That's it. Incisors, canines, and premolars that grow in after you're a baby.
Some sort of teeth.
Yes. They're not the temporary ones.
Permanent teeth.
Your permanent teeth is right? Nadia Comaneci was the first gymnast to score this at the Olympics.
Oh, perfect 10.
That's it, and here's your last one. What holds the fuel in a British car?
Oh, a petrol tank.
Nice job. 100%.
Nice.
Daniel, you needed zero help, and you answered in record time. Extremely impressive. How do you feel?
Relieved.
You should be proud and relieved. You are fantastic.
Thank you.
And for playing our puzzle today, you'll get a weekend edition lapel pin, as well as puzzle books and games. You can read all about it at npr.org/puzzle. And Daniel, what member station do you listen to?
KANW.
Thank you for being a listener. That, again, is Daniel Abramson of Albuquerque, New Mexico. Thanks so much for playing the puzzle.
Thanks so much.
Will, what is next week's challenge?
Yes, it comes from Ward Hartenstein of Rochester, New York. I said, think of a well-known couple whose names are often said in the order of blank and blank. 7 letters in the names in total. Combine these 2 names, change an E to an S, and rearrange the result to name another famous duo who are widely known as blank and blank. Who are they? So again, a well-known couple. Their names are blank and blank. 7 letters in the names in total. Combine the 2 names, change an E to an S, and rearrange the result, and you'll get another famous duo widely known as blank and blank. What couples are these?
And when you have the answer, go to our website, npr.org/puzzle, to submit your response. Just fill out the form on the puzzle page. Remember, just 1 entry, please. Our deadline for entries this week is Thursday, January 15th at 3 p.m. Eastern. Don't forget to include a phone number where we can reach you. If you're the winner, we'll give you a call. And if you pick up the phone, you get to play on the air with a puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition, Will Shortz. Will, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Sasha.
Help wanted, treasure hunter. That's the gist of what the British Museum is looking for in a new hire. The institution is still reeling from a heist discovered there more than 2 years ago. Hundreds of rare artifacts worth millions of dollars were stolen from its ancient Greek and Roman collections. As art newspaper reporter Martin Bailey told my colleague Scott Simon in 2023,
the fact is that we outside the museum don't know what's lost, and I suspect that even within the museum, it's not quite clear what has gone missing or has been stolen.
The museum wants to track down these missing artifacts, and it needs a new, dedicated member of its staff to do that. So what are the job qualifications? Maybe a fedora and whip?
It belongs in a museum. So do you.
Not quite. The job description is light on outrunning boulders and heavy on archival research and record keeping. Think more librarian than Indiana Jones. So, would-be applicants, don't let your phobias stand in the way.
Snakes. Why did it have to be snakes?
Instead, you'll need an eye for ancient gold jewelry, precious stones, and glass. Not to mention a network of contacts in the world of art dealers and collectors. The museum estimates that 1,500 artifacts were taken. More than 600 have been recovered so far. Finding the rest will likely take ingenuity and maybe some quick thinking, just like on the big screen.
I don't know. I'm making this up as I go.
And while there may not be any foot chases, booby traps, or ancient curses involved, the clock is ticking. Some of the stolen goods have popped up on resale websites like eBay. And museum officials are concerned it's just a matter of time before the stolen gold is melted down. As the head of the museum's Greek and Roman collection, Tom Harrison, recently told the Times of London, the search will continue until he is, quote, retired or under the ground. So if you're an ancient history buff who loves a treasure hunt, why not fill out an application? We're just a few weeks away from the torch being lit over Milan and another Olympic Winter Games. And if you want to get in the mood beforehand, why not watch a movie? Will Leach is a sports writer and host of the movie podcast Grierson and Leach, and he's with us to share his picks for best winter sports movies. Hi, Will.
Hello. I'm excited. I'm already carrying my proverbial torch.
Well, I'm excited too because I've been watching trailers all morning to remind myself of all the great sports movies out there. And I wonder if you can go through with us a bit sport by sport. So let's say ice hockey. What comes to mind?
Well, the fun of hockey as both a subject for a movie and of course, as a sport, is it's both inspiring and also incredibly violent. And so hockey is able to give us both of those things in movie form. Probably the most famous hockey movie, and I would say the best hockey movie, is, of course, Slapshot.
Paul Newman, Coach Reggie Dunlop in this supercharged world of hockey, invites you to meet the crazies who make it that way.
Paul Newman's ode to the Rust Belt minor league hockey teams, directed by George Roy Hill. It's a wonderful film with the famous Hanson brothers that are always getting in a fight. It won't remind you of Olympic hockey, I would say, but it certainly will make you definitely appreciate the game and also appreciate your teeth, which is a big part of any kind of movie-going experience. But for the more like Olympic hockey experience, the most famous hockey movie, and I think one of the best ones, is Miracle, which is, of course, about the 1980 U.S. hockey team, Kurt Russell.
I got no time for quitters.
You want me to play, huh?
I want you to be a hockey player.
I am a hockey player.
Think that'll get him going?
Oh, yeah.
People love a certain arc for sports movies. The scrappy underdogs all get together, and at first they struggle, and they even kind of battle with each other a little bit, but then they come together as a team and all win the big game. And there's really, in real life, the canonical example of that is, of course, the 80 U.S. hockey team.
You know, you mentioned Paul Newman, and that's making me think of a different movie that involves Paul Newman's sidekick, Robert Redford. This is this 1969 movie, Downhill Racer, about downhill skiing. Is that one that it sort of falls into your best of list?
It's a wonderful film, and it's funny, the late, great Roger Ebert famously called that the best movie ever made about sports without really actually being about sports.
88. Abe, you're starting in the sixth group. It's the best we can get for you. You should be higher, but that's all we can do for you right now.
What's the point of even racing?
Same as always, you try to win.
Starting 88th, I'll be in ruts up to my knees.
Probably.
It's a very kind of underappreciated Redford performance. You know, he's obviously was this like very classic movie star, but there's something kind of aloof and fascinating about his character and the way he plays him in that movie. And I think it speaks to the sport, right? Like the idea, we get excited about these sports and these team sports and everyone coming together, but the movie kind of really captures how kind of lonely being an athlete can be and how kind of isolating it is and how that desperate need to win can kind of erode at your soul, but still help you win. And I think it's definitely the best skiing film that you'll find going into these Olympics.
Figure skating tends to have had a fair amount of movies made after it. What are your favorites in the figure skating world?
There are two that are actually quite different, but I think both very enjoyable. More recently, I think I, Tonya is probably the really fun one. It features a terrific performance by Margot Robbie as Tonya Harding.
Hey, how do I get a fair shot here? Because I'm up at 5 every morning working my ass off. Does someone want to just tell me to my face you're never going to give me the scores I deserve?
We also judge on presentation. Well, you know what? If you can come up with $5,000 for a costume for me, then I won't have to make one. Till then, just stay out of my face.
One of the best things about that movie is at the time when we were all watching that, when Tonya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan thing happened, it was just kind of funny because it was like, wow, this is like mobsters involving figure skating. This very dainty sport is suddenly has people getting hit with crowbars and there's guys named Galooly. But one of the things that's great kind of about that movie is it gives you the context of like, sure, you might only think about figure skating once every 4 years, but this is the entire lives of all of these people. They take it extremely seriously. And obviously the stakes get incredibly high, particularly when it comes to the Olympics.
Good.
Another great one is The Cutting Edge, which is actually this great contrast between this classical figure skater played by Maura Kelly and this tough hockey player who's no longer to play a sport, played by D.B. Sweeney.
Would you please put me down? Oh, you cretin!
Guess that move needs some work.
They actually become figure skating partners, and he learns to become graceful and a better person and realizes that ice skating is more than just hitting guys with your stick.
Another movie that tends to be really beloved for a lot of people was Cool Runnings, the true story of the Jamaican bobsled team.
Feel the rhythm! Feel the ride! Get on up! It's bobsled time!
What are your thoughts on that one?
One of the fun of the Winter Olympics is this idea that, like, sure, someone's going to win the gold, someone's going to win the silver, someone's going to win the bronze, we're all going to have these champions. But the fun of the Olympics, too, is a lot of times the people that don't win, but it's just kind of remarkable that they're here in the first place and they're getting this moment to shine. I think Cool Runnings tells that story very well. The Olympics, to be there is such an achievement. It's incredible that you're there, and I think Cool Runnings does a really terrific job of kind of showing that.
It also shows us how a sport that a lot of people aren't familiar with works. I mean, we all may know the basics of football and basketball, but suddenly we were learning the intricacies of bobsledding and how to train for it and what it involves. So it's a little window into more of a niche sports world.
And one of the most fun things about the Olympics in general is we can have sports that we've never seen before. And at the end of the 2 weeks, we're experts. We know everything about the sports. And then we will forget all of it until we watch it again 4 years later. And that is a wonderful, wonderful thing about the Olympics.
Will, is there a sport that has not gotten the big screen treatment that you think would make a good movie?
I feel like luge. Luge is like, it's a little similar to bobsledding. And it's a hard thing to do, right? It's a hard thing to really dramatize because you're just one person on a sled going very, very fast. The idea of speed and the solitude of that is actually pretty dramatically rich. We've seen it a lot with like auto race movies. We've never really seen it for luge in a lot of ways. And that every time I watch that sport, I'm like, wow, they're going so fast and they're so alone. How scary that must be.
One of my NPR colleagues and editor, Melissa Gray, talked about maybe could you imagine a movie about Zamboni drivers? You know, it's not exactly winter sport, kind of winter sports adjacent. What do you think about that one?
It sure feels like that is a straight-to-Netflix Adam Sandler comedy waiting to happen, doesn't it? Doesn't it feel like that would be a great one? And maybe he's a little bit too intense. You could also go the darker direction and have like a very intense method actor play like a slightly psychotic Zamboni driver who's obsessed with a hockey player. But I think Zamboni, it's hard to be too serious about a Zamboni. I think you probably need an Adam Sandler kind of like wacky comedy to do that. But yeah, I would enjoy that. I don't know how exciting a Zamboni race would be, however.
Yeah.
I feel like that would be a hard thing to dramatize in a truly exciting way.
That's sports writer and film critic Will Leach. Will, thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you for having me. Enjoy the Olympics.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. Thank you for listening. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. From the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. It's the Back to Hack Festival in Hackensack, January 16th through the 18th. Activities include the Frostbite Your Fanny Fun Run, Snow Golf, kids games, fireworks, and more. Find a full schedule at HackensackChamber.com. Minnesota State Park offers free admission Monday, January 19th. There are 75 parks and recreation areas across the state, so you can visit an old favorite or explore somewhere new. The Cohasset Parks and Recs Department has snowshoe hikes at Tioga Recreation Area on Mondays and Thursdays at 1:30. Meet at the bike trail parking lot. The city will provide snowshoes if you don't have them. All experience levels welcome. You can build a cardboard sled Tuesday, January 13th at King Elementary in Deer River from 3:30 to 5. Sleds can be used in the second annual Cardboard Classic on Saturday, January 17th. Supplies will be provided. Now I'll take you back to Weekend Edition here on KAXE KBXE.